families and lead us into Easter. So why don't we give Pastor Caleb a round of applause as well. Thank you for being our pastor.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, what a wave to ride off, hey, those baptisms this weekend. It's just been so fantastic. I was down there on Good Friday. I wasn't in the water baptizing, but I was actually on the beach, and Pete and Jack and Blake were in the water, and there was our five or six guys, and then they probably baptized another 30 people. And it was quite incredible because people had come from all over Melbourne. There was a guy that we baptized from Lawn. There was ones from up near the city, out in Clyde North, Pakenham, all over the place. And I was on the beach with a few other ones from our church. And as they came out of the water baptized, we were praying over them. So we got to spend 5 or 10 minutes just praying with them as they're standing there dripping wet on the sand at Frankston foreshore. We had to prophesy over them, which means just praying about their future and what God will do, and then talk to them about what's happened. Why did you come down today? How did you hear about this? And the stories were just so broad of God entering their life and doing many, many things in their hearts. One thing that was probably a little bit sad or maybe interesting was the fact that most of them weren't connected to a church. So it's really, really interesting, this kind of journey to God. They've had friends or whatever, but they weren't really connected to a church. And it's so important to be in a church, to be in a community, to help your faith grow. And all of them were kind of open to that, but that's really the next step for them. And so we just prayed for them that God would show them the right place to go. And it was just, yeah, just an incredible time. So I've got some big news to announce. It's kind of some family news. Later on in this year, the second half of this year, we are going to be going away for 5 months. So I don't know if that's something to clap about, but yeah, I'm happy. Thank you. Thank you. Some of you are like, thank goodness. See you later. Now, we're going to do a big lap of Australia. It's actually a half lap. That's actually the route we're going to kind of do. We're going to be away for 5 months from July through to Christmas time. We'll probably do about 20,000 kilometres on this trip. I'm sure that we'll come back and you probably won't remember us. You'll be like, we are fine without you. You can sit up the back now. We have got this thing. We've got this church running. So it's a real gift that we are able to be released for this time. It's my long service leave, obviously, and a chance just to have a sabbatical and rest. So important to rest. I've never had a long service leave before. Zoe's never had long service leave, so she won't be working for that whole time ahead. And it's quite an adventure. It's quite an adventure. I don't know if anyone's done any long-term travel before, maybe overseas when you were young, or maybe you've done a big lap or some caravanning or something like that. You know, the adventure is exciting. You know that the end of this trip is going to be amazing. And you're probably sitting there going, oh, it'd be nice to do something like that. And we're sitting here going, wow, we can't wait to do this adventure. By the time we come back in December, it's going to be amazing. You know, we'll be probably experts at caravanning and towing and reversing caravans, and we'll know all of these places around Australia. You know, I've never been to Uluru and seen Ayers Rock, so that'll be a first time for me, and it's just going to be this incredible adventure. The kids won't be in school, so it'll be just maximum family time together, creating once-in-a-lifetime adventures. You know the end is going to be fantastic, but you know you don't begin at the end, right? You begin at the start. There's a way to start. There's a way into this adventure. And the way into this adventure, it's actually not as easy as we thought it would be. You've got to get money from the bank. You've got to buy a caravan. You've got to get a car. You've got to organize to get off work, two jobs. We've got to get off work. We've got to take the kids out of school. There's all the stress and strain of like, how do you travel around Australia for 6 months? I've never driven a caravan before. How do I drive a caravan? What happens if we're in the outback and we run out of water, or the car conks down, or, you know, Zoe's really worried that we're going to get eaten by crocodiles somewhere in far north Queensland. Like, you know, there's all of these things that actually, there's actually a whole transition phase of getting out of the normal Botanic Ridge, work in the church, send the kids to school, the normal lifestyle. There's something kind of secure, right, about your normal lifestyle. Yeah, there's the adventure coming that you want to get to, but how do you get over there is actually quite a bit of a challenge. that's what I want to talk about today. Because this, as I realized and we reflected on this, Zoe and I, it's like this is a pattern of life, right? There's some place that we always want to get to. There's some goal we have in our mind for our family, for our life, and for our spiritual work. I can tell you dead set that God, like you heard today in Susan's testimony, he has a plan for you. He wants to take you somewhere fantastic. But to get into that, to enter into that at some point, you've got to exit out of where you are now and get onto that journey. If you're single, moving to marriage is exciting, but it's an exit to enter something, and there's kind of an in-between phase of a romantic relationship which can be quite confusing and doesn't always end in marriage. If you've left a job, that can be exciting about the new job that's coming, or maybe you got a promotion and you're going up in your work, but the transition is not always easy. But to get to the good, you've got to leave something that's familiar. To enter into something new, you've got to exit something, and that's not always easy. Moving house, moving jobs, having a child. Who remembers having their first child if you've had kids before? You know, it's very exciting. You know, you're going to raise this child and you see the future, but then all of a sudden the reality of having a kid, raising a kid and not sleeping for the next decade is quite a challenge. It's quite a challenge. There's a way through that is a challenge. And this is what we call, or what the Bible calls, the Exodus way. Can everyone say that? The Exodus way. So who's been going through the book of Exodus with us? Well done. We've done 40 chapters of Exodus as we've gone through 40 days of Lent, remembering that Jesus went through 40 days in the desert as we headed into this Easter time. And this Exodus way, as you can see on the screen, is very familiar to us. If you've read through the 40 chapters of Exodus, the whole book is about the people of Israel being released from slavery. And it's this pattern. So there's an exodus, there's an exit, there's a leaving. There's this great bit at the end. You enter life and a goal, or for the Israelites, it was the promised land. Or for us, it's going to be the end of this family adventure in December and how amazing it's going to be and life-changing it's going to be and the memories we'll make. There's an entrance, but the in-between bit can often be hard. It can be confusing. And can be a lot of effort and a lot of work. It can be a trial. It can be a time of testing. The Exodus way. This pattern often involves God providing for people a way out. Some kind of oppression or difficulty or something needs to change. God provides a way out. But he also provides a way through. Everyone say a way through. There's a way out, but then there's got to be a way through. And this way through in our lives is often a period of challenge, testing in your marriage, difficulty in your workplace, wrestling through a midlife crisis, change when there's a death in the family or something goes wrong. There's a time of wrestle, but God provides a way through the challenge and there's an entrance into a new life. So I want to look at three Exoduses today, and I'm going to try and wrap up our Exodus series because I wanted to be true to that we've read these 40 chapters. I didn't want to leave that behind and just move on with Easter. So I want to look at Israel's Exodus. It's up on the screen for you, Egypt to the Promised Land. I want to look at Jesus' Exodus because it's the Easter weekend, right? From death to life, so Good Friday to Easter Sunday. And then we'll look at what that means for us, our Exodus, or our exit from spiritual slavery into spiritual freedom. Does that sound okay? Who thinks Pastor Caleb can do that in half an hour? Yeah, not many of you. You guys have been around for too long, haven't you? I'm going to finish up by taking communion together. I've cut down my passages right down to only two verses, so we'll see how we go. The first one, to be true to our Exodus reading, is let's finish off with a couple of verses from Exodus chapter 40, which hopefully you got all the way through and you read this. So it's in verse 34. Then the cloud covered the tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could no longer enter the tabernacle because the cloud had settled down over it and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So if you've read the 40 chapters of Exodus, there's a lot of action at the start, right? The people are in slavery in Egypt. They cry out to Yahweh to set us free. God sends a deliverer, Moses who comes and delivers them. There's the 10 plagues. There's the Passover feast in Exodus chapter 12. There's the great leaving of Egypt and then the crossing over the Red Sea and the grumbling in the desert and the manna that comes from heaven and then the quail that comes from heaven because they wanted meat and they weren't happy with the manna. So God's done all of these miracles. And we get to about chapter 20. We see the 10 commandments come, Mount Sinai. Moses comes down with the 10 commandments. Chapter 32, we had a sermon about that, the golden calf. They worship this golden calf. But then we have a lot of chapters in there, maybe 10 or 15 chapters, where God is on the mountain with Moses. And he's talking to him about building this tabernacle, or a tent, basically. It's like a, let's use caravanning terms, it's like an annex, okay? It's like a tent. But God is going to fill this tent so that the people can worship God, and God won't be far off up a mountain, but he'll be down on the ground with the people. And so God explains this, and we read all of these chapters about candlesticks and altars and about priestly garments and about curtains and about arks and about gold covering things and all of these things. And then we read all these chapters about them actually building those things. They build the ark and they build the altars and they do the priestly garments and they put it all together. And so we kind of repeat it all a second time. And then we get to chapter 40. Moses has hung the last curtain of the tabernacle, the tent. And then the glory of God, the cloud that was up on Mount Sinai that had been there, or the cloud that they had followed to help them know where to go, all of a sudden this cloud comes down to the tent of meeting and it fills the tent. And the cloud isn't just like a bit of fog or mist in the morning. It's not like a smoke cloud. It's full of splendor and glory and majesty and divinity. It's the presence of God, but now they can see it. It's tangible, not just invisible. And it's so powerful that they can't even get near it. They can't even enter. Even Moses couldn't enter the tent of meeting. But now God's promise is fulfilled. What we heard early in Exodus, that God wants to come and he wants to be with his people. He wants to be near and be in personal relationship with them. Now God has come down from the mountain and he has entered in among them and he wants to dwell with his people. And the very last verse of the whole of Exodus, the very last verse of Exodus chapter 40, it says that God was with them in this cloud and directed them on all of their journeys. Now, where is this journey going? Because if you read on from Exodus, God is taking them to the promised land. Everyone say promised land. So they begin in Egypt, oppression, slavery. There's an in-between period. How long does it take them to get through the desert? 40 years. 11-day trip took them 40 years because of the grumbling and the complaining. And eventually, because they're so rebellious and difficult, God says, I'm going to wait for the whole older generation to die in the desert. And I'll just take through the younger generation into the promised land because they'll be with me and obey me. And only two men survived from the older generation, Joshua and his good buddy, Caleb, you got it. That's who I'm named after. Joshua and Caleb, the only two that survive. Not even Moses enters the promised land. But this is where God takes, and we see this Exodus way again. There's slavery, there's oppression, there's deliverance. There's an in-between period of confusion and working through and challenge, but God shows a way through. And then there's a promised land flowing with milk and honey, life, freedom. You have your own cities. Everyone's going to have their own house. There's going to be enough food to eat. There's going to be no oppression in this land. This is the Exodus way, the Exodus story. This is the most commonly referenced story in all of the Bible. Exodus is mentioned again and again and again by the prophets in the Old Testament. And then we get into the New Testament. And again, it's referenced again and again and again, now as a metaphor for our spiritual deliverance from spiritual slavery. And now Moses, it's not about Moses the deliverer from the Old Testament, it's about a better Moses that has come, Jesus Christ. And this better Moses, Jesus, has better promises from God, not the old promises, but now there's going to be better promises. And now it's not the old covenant or agreement with God and the Ten Commandments and the laws and the prophets. No, it's a new covenant or a new agreement between God and people. Not just the Jews now, but all people are welcome to come into relationship with God. God has come close through Jesus Christ now. Jesus is the tabernacle, but in human form. No longer a tent or a temple, but now Jesus, John 1:14, has dwelled among the people and he has made God known. So who is God? What does God look like? What is God's character like? You look at Jesus. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And now God does not dwell in a tent. He dwelt among the people. In Luke chapter 9, verse 28, there's this fascinating story called the Transfiguration or the Transformation of Jesus. I want to read to you a few verses and see if you can pick up a little bit of a connection here with what we've just read about the cloud of and the glory of God filling the tabernacle. Luke 9, verse 28. About 8 days later, Jesus took Peter, John, and James up on a mountain to pray. And he was praying, and as he was praying, the appearance of his face was transformed, and his clothes became dazzling white. Verse 30, suddenly two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared and began talking with Jesus. They were glorious to see, and they were speaking about his exodus from this world, which was about to be fulfilled in Jerusalem. And then the next few verses tell us that God comes down on this mountain as a cloud, and he overshadows Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, who are all dazzling white, full of glory, and also Peter, James, and John. So all six of them are enveloped in this glory cloud, if you like. And a voice comes from the cloud and says, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." The voice of God. You might remember the story because Peter says some funny things and fumbles over himself. But the message is, "This is my son. Listen to him. Obey him. If you're going to do anything, follow him." Now we see here, this is very similar to the last few verses of the tabernacle and the glory of God. Now we've got a mountain that Jesus has gone up to pray on. We've got the glory and Jesus' face is transformed. Who read through Exodus? This will test you and read the part about Moses coming down from the mountain and his face was transformed and the Israelites couldn't look at his face because of the glory of God shining upon it. So they put a bag over his head. They put a veil over him because the glory was too much. And now Jesus, the better Moses, is transformed. And actually, as he's transfigured in front of his disciples, he's gone from a smelly carpenter hanging out with fishermen, first century, wearing daggy clothes, covered in dirt because they walked on dusty roads. And all of a sudden, he's with his best three friends, the closest three of his disciples, and he's transfigured in front of their eyes. And they see, oh, he's been saying he's God. He's been saying he's the Messiah. Now we see. All of a sudden now, like God, because remember, these are good Jewish boys. They know all the stories of the Old Testament. Now, like God, he is full of glory. He is shining with splendor. His face is transfigured. Just like Moses had a shining face, he has a shining face. And if they weren't quite sure, Moses himself and Elijah appear and stand next to him just to give maximum evidence that this is the one that Moses had pointed to in the commandments, because he represents the law. And then Elijah had pointed to, and he represents the prophets. Remember, Jesus himself said, "I've come to fulfill the law and the prophets." So Moses and Elijah are there going, "This is the guy fulfilling everything from the Old Testament." If you weren't sure, he's shining like a god in front of his disciples, and a cloud overshadows them, just like in the tabernacle. But what was the content of the discussion between Moses, Elijah, and Jesus as they were having a nice little chat in this glory cloud on top of the mountain with Peter, James, and John going, "Oh my goodness, what is happening?" The content of their discussion, let's go back to it in verse 30, They were speaking about his exodus from this world. So interestingly, the gospel writer here, Luke, grabs the word exodus, the same word that is used for the exodus that we read about, the chapter 40s of Exodus, and says that how was Jesus going to depart? What was Jesus' way out? How was Jesus going to exit? What was his exodus? Well, it was through death. Jesus' departure from this world would be through death. That was the way out. So let's look at this, the exodus way as it applies to Jesus. Jesus' way out was death. That's Good Friday, 2 days ago. Jesus in between, confusing time, disciples are unsure what's going on. Jesus is dead, our Savior. He's not meant to die. He's meant to be God. Peter, James, and John are like, I saw him transfigured about a week ago because his transfiguration just happened right at the beginning of the Passion Week. It was only a week later that he's dead. So he went from transfigured Moses, Elijah, to crucified by the Romans in a tomb. So this in between. But then what comes? The promised land. Life comes. He's resurrected from the dead. Easter Sunday today, there's new life. Death could not hold him down. Let's look at this. We'll stay in Luke, since we're using Luke's gospel. In Luke 23, verse 44, by this time about noon, and darkness fell across the whole land until 3 o'clock. The light from the sun was gone. Suddenly, the curtain in the sanctuary of the temple was torn in the middle. So this is the curtain that we hear about in Exodus. Now it's not a tabernacle or a tent anymore. It's a temple built with pillars of stone, but it's still the same curtain that separates everybody from the presence of God. This is torn down the middle. And verse 46, as the temple curtain is torn, right at that moment, Jesus shouts, Father, I entrust my spirit into your hands. And with those words, he breathed his last. You see, Jesus had to die on Good Friday. There was no two ways about it. God must have an atonement or a sacrifice. Somebody had to die to appease the holiness and the righteousness of God. Now, if you track through this Exodus series with us the last week, and forgive me if it's your first day here, you've come with a friend, we're on the end of a big reading here. If you've tracked with us, you've seen a very holy God give out commandments about the behavior he expects, not allow people to come too close to the mountain. If you cross onto this mountain, you will die. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of threats from God. But we've talked about how this isn't God being unkind. This is God showing that he's holy and he's not your bro. You just can't approach him and run up to him and give him a big hug. He is God and he is divine and he is holy. He must be approached correctly. So God demanded a sacrifice because it was man that had sinned, Adam and Eve in the garden. We have all sinned. There had to be a human that was his sacrifice. But the sacrifice, the human sacrifice to stand in the place to pay the price for sin and death could not be found. God had looked all throughout the world, all the generations, Moses and King David and Elijah and Isaiah. Now, even the prophets, even the greatest Christian men from the Old Testament, none of them were good enough. But it had to be a human. It couldn't be an animal. So that ultimate sacrifice had to be a human. But then it had to be a perfect human because you can't give a holy God an imperfect sacrifice. So there's only one way that this problem could be solved. God's righteousness had to be appeased, and that had to be through a human, and that human had to be without sin. So the only way is that there would be a God-man that would come. There had to be a man who was of the earth, born of a woman, but a man who was also at the same time God and born from above. So it was Jesus Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, but he also had to be Jesus, the bloke from Nazareth, who was a man who lived in the first century and was a carpenter for his job, who had a father named Joseph and a mum named Mary and had an accent from the region of Galilee, that bloke. He had to be fully man, but he also had to be the Son of God, the Messiah, the chosen one. It had to be a human, but it had to be a perfect human. So God demanded that man pay the price. But then God paid the price as a substitute for all human beings, himself. In Luke 23:48, it says, when all the crowd that had come to see the crucifixion saw what had happened, they went home in deep sorrow. This is about all we get told about Saturday. The Bible doesn't talk about Saturday or the in-between time at all. It's purposely left blank. All we know is that people went home in deep sorrow, and we know that it was the Sabbath. So the Jewish people were all resting. No one was doing any work. No one was busying themselves with any activity. Even the women couldn't go to the tomb to put the oil and the spices on Jesus because it was the Sabbath. They had to rest. So it's a day of deep sorrow, of grief. It's a day of confusion and in-between time. You imagine all the disciples and friends of Jesus, and even Jesus' own mother Mary, can't go to the tomb of her own son. You're just sitting at home for 24 hours. What's happened? We had 3.5 years of Jesus doing miracles. He raised the dead, and now he's dead? What's happening here? Why is this? This isn't how this was meant to work out. There's pain, there's sorrow, there's darkness, there's confusion. You imagine all the conversations happening on that Saturday. What is going on? Are we going to now be targeted by the Romans? What if they burst into our house tomorrow and we are crucified for following Jesus? Maybe they're just going to exterminate everybody from Galilee. It's happened before. The Romans have just come and crushed this Jesus movement. Luke 24, verse 6. Let's stay with the gospel writer Luke. He tells us in verse 6 of chapter 24, he isn't here. The women have gone to the tomb early in the morning. And the angel says to them, he isn't here. He is risen from the dead. Remember what he told you back in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be betrayed into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and that he would rise again on the third day? Then they remembered that he had said this. It all came flooding back to them. He had predicted that he would die and rise again. And if he's truly God, Mark Oliver, who was leading worship this morning, said it to us today. This is the perfect evidence. This is the greatest evidence for Jesus Christ, not being just a historical figure from the first century, but actually being the Son of God. It makes sense. If you were God, I'm sure you would have thought of the same thing. A resurrection from the dead is the ultimate proof that he is God. The big question is, what happened to his body? The women went to the tomb. He wasn't there. The angel said, why are you looking for somebody that's alive among all of the dead people, the tombs? Peter ran down to the tomb and he looked in as well, and it was clear. And the Bible tells us he went home puzzled. Confused, what's going on? The Jews said that his body was stolen, and they came up with a fabricated story, which you can read in one of the Gospels, about where the body went. It was stolen, or it was smuggled away by his followers. The modern day secularists or atheists or humanists will tell us that, well, this whole thing's a story. It's just some crazy people, uneducated people from the first century that came up with this myth and this story and created this religion and this Bible. It's all about power and money and building big churches, and it's all just a myth. It's all just hysterical people who need religion in order to survive and get through life. They just made it all up. But all four gospel writers, including the Apostle Paul, who wrote half of the New Testament, tell us that Jesus appeared to over 500 people over the next 40 days. He actually kept showing up in rooms, just randomly, just bang, and he's there. Peace be with you. Amazingly, he's showing up, and the Bible tells us that they doubted. Many of them, their hearts were still full with doubt. You know the story of doubting Thomas, where Jesus says, look, my hands, there's still holes in them. Look at my feet, there's still holes from my crucifixion, my side, where they stuck the spear. See, he proves that he's the same person, but now he's resurrected. He appears to over 500 over the next 40 days. Don't we love that number 40? There it is again. And then eventually he ascends to heaven, and for 10 days there's nothing until the Holy Spirit comes. So 50 days after his resurrection, the Holy Spirit comes on the Feast of Pentecost, what we now call the Day of Pentecost. All of his disciples and many of his earlier followers died brutal deaths of martyrdom for their belief that they saw Jesus with their own eyes. After he was dead, they saw him alive. Why would these men die for a hoax? Why would they get together and go, yeah, let's all die brutal, brutal deaths. Let's be tortured. Let's be betrayed by our communities. Let's be poor and have no money. Let's be thought of as absolute idiots and be discarded from society just because we came up with this little story. No, they all went to the grave so confident to face death because they know that they had seen with their own eyes Jesus Christ. And within their own lifetimes, before their martyrdom, they wrote down these stories for us. And now what we call Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and what we call the New Testament, they wrote down these stories to give us proof of what happened. So let's finish this morning. We'll take communion in about 10 minutes. What does all of this mean for us? Our Exodus. Israel, this great story of Exodus out of slavery in Egypt. Jesus, his own exodus from this world and death, because he had to go out in pain in order to come back in glory with his resurrection. What does this mean for us? What does this mean for Susan, who got baptized today? Or David and Tara, Lauren, Stacey, these people got baptized over the weekend. Why? Why get baptized? Why commit your life to Jesus? Jesus is our exodus from slavery and our entrance into freedom. This is the whole point of being a Christian, being a believer, being a follower. The early Christians were called followers of the way. Talking about the Exodus way this morning, they were called followers of the way. They weren't called Christians until many, many years later, and it was actually a derogatory term that was labeled on them. It wasn't a positive term. They were criticized and called Christians. Initially, the followers of Jesus were called followers of the way. There's this way from death to life, from spiritual slavery, the things of this world, enslaved to money, enslaved to workaholism, enslaved to your anxieties and your traumas and your childhood. And there's all these things we're enslaved to in this world that suck us down. And there's enslaved to the news and geopolitics and wars in foreign countries and petrol prices going up. And a lot of people live and they bounce to and fro, enslaved to our husband, our wife, our kids, our this, our that. That maybe the own pressure we put on ourselves, maybe our own voice inside of our head that beats us up or pushes us on to greater things, or our willpower that we're going to be stronger again and go again and make something of my life. We're enslaved and tempted to be enslaved to so many things in this world. Spiritual enslavement. But Jesus offers us freedom. Freedom for our hearts. Freedom for our minds. He is our exodus. He is our way out of spiritual slavery, pain, and torment. He is our way through the confusion, because like the disciples, many of us are like, yeah, Jesus, but I'm not sure. I have some doubts. I've got some big questions. And that's okay. Jesus, God, Pastor Caleb, us at Discover Church, we're not afraid of your questions, your wrestles, your struggles. But Jesus is the way through that desert time. Many people I know that have been a Christian for a long time have moments and seasons in their life of deep doubt and confusion about their faith. But he is also our entrance into our promised land. Not just once, but time and time again. The exit from sin and death, if we jump onto the next slide, our exit from sin and death is through Jesus Christ. Death is a result of sin. The whole reason that humans die, see, humans were not created by God to die. He created Adam and Eve to live forever. His intent wasn't that they would die, but it's their disobedience, or what we call sin. They're choosing their own way outside of God's way that led mankind to separate from God. God didn't want separation. He created man to be close. But they said, nah, I think there's a better way. There's my way. I see a different way. That's what we call sin. It's when we disobey God's best for us and we choose another way. This results in wars, pain, abuses, all the evil and the suffering of this world is not God's intention, but it's He has handed over choice to us. And through choice, humans have created pain. I love what you said, Susan, in your video, that God saved me from myself. And so often that's such a great insight, Susan, because it's easy to say, oh, they did it and they hurt me and this is difficult and the government and whatever. But really, it's coming to that place to believe in Jesus, you've got to come to that place of, it's actually something wrong with me. I need help. I'm too weak. I don't know. I can't do it again. I can't go again. And you give of your life to Jesus. You give over your power. You give over your freedom of choice and say, I'm going to choose you, Jesus, once and for all. And this resurrection we've spoken of today is the core belief. If you ever have a friend who says, what is it all about this stuff? We can come back to today's sermon, basically. It's about the resurrection. If you believe Jesus came back from the dead, that's one of the core critical elements to the fact that Jesus is God. I believe that He rose again. So powerful. Water baptism is like our in-between. What we saw today as people go through the waters of baptism is our in-between. How do we get from sin and death to this new life? Thank you, Helen. The waters of baptism. And it's not just the act that we saw today, but it's the lead-up. It's the questions. I know there's many people in the church right now. I've got friends I'm talking to who aren't at church, and there's this wrestle, this lead-up to baptism. Do I really believe that Jesus rose from the dead? Do I really want to give my heart and therefore my life and everything over to God? Do I want to do that? That's the wrestle. Do I want to be transformed by God, or do I want to keep doing it my own way and not do it God's way? I'm not sure about that. Baptism and the decision to get baptized and everything leading up to that is like the bridge from death to life, from your own way, the bridge to God's better way. From the old way that every human tries to do in their own strength, but coming over to God's way. Let Him help you. Let Him lead you. Let Him show you the way forward. Before you cross over from sin and death, it's very hard to see. The Bible talks about your eyes being blind. People can have Jesus right in front of them, but they can't see them because their heart is closed. People can have a great Christian friend and think, man, you're so cool and you're free in Jesus and, man, I love your faith and all of that, but they still can't see because their heart is closed. Just like Moses had a veil put over his face because of the glory, the Apostle Paul says it's like before we know Jesus, we have a veil over our hearts. We can't see God clearly. Our heart is not pure, therefore we can't see God. It's the transformation of the heart that bridges us from life to death. I have to be honest with you, Discover Church, it's so important to remember this, even if you've been a Christian for 20 years. Your attendance at church is not the reason your heart gets transformed. Your knowledge of the Bible and knowing the Scriptures, understanding theology is great, but that's not the thing that ultimately transforms your heart. Being very experienced with church activity and ministry, being involved in the church, telling people about your faith, fantastic. But that's not the thing that transforms your heart. It's not Alpha. It's not a program. It's not a course. It's not a life group. It's not a Christian activity. It's not a conference. It's not being down the beach at Good Friday. The only thing that transforms your heart is Jesus Christ. And having a personal friendship with Jesus Christ, He can help you exit from pain if you're in any kind of pain, stress, turmoil, confusion. He can help you through that confusing time, whether it's leaving a job, whether it's sorting out marriage stuff, whether it's going through difficulties with your friendships or having a new baby. He can help you through. He alone can help you through. The Bible, the church, all these things are tools, but they've all got to point towards Jesus Christ. All of these things are like Elijah and Moses that we heard in the Transfiguration. They're all pointing towards Jesus. If there's anything that's not pointing you towards Jesus in Discover Church, come and tell me, because we are a church centered on Jesus Christ. Not about me or this stage or Sunday morning at 10 a.m. It's about Jesus among us. that has the power to transform our life. And as he bridges us over to the other side, there's new life. We come into the promised land. We come into a spiritual freedom. You will still have problems in your life even once you have accepted Jesus Christ. But Jesus will provide a way through that pain. You will still live on this earth and suffer injustices in your marriage, at your work, with your friends. You'll have financial trouble. Your things will go on. But the fact that Jesus rose from the dead gives you hope to push through. Because if he came back from the dead, you will have a resurrection on your life on the third day. You may be experiencing pain, turmoil, difficulty, have friends that are sick, have struggles, whatever's going on. But the fact that there was Good Friday, yes, there's pain. We acknowledge that. We embrace that. But Good Friday is followed by Easter Sunday. There is hope in his resurrection. And even if you don't receive justice in this world, or if things don't work out with your family in this world, or if you never get righted in this world where you deserved it, or that money is never paid back, or you never quite deal with your mental health or your anxiety issues or your physical problems or whatever they are, even if it doesn't happen in this world, you can have hope that in the next world, because Christ has risen from the dead, because he ascended to heaven, and he is coming back to get you again at some point in history in the future. He will return. You can have hope that in the next world, there will be ultimate justice. There will be divine justice. Your body will be made whole. You will see your friends that believed in Jesus and family members that have died. You will be reunited with them. You will have a full physical body. You will have clear mental health. You will have perfect relationships in the next life because Jesus has risen, and that is our ultimate.